results a turning point for his ruling Justice and Development Party. Thank you for joining us. It's almost 6 months since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza, and the regime's warplanes and artillery keep pounding the besieged strip, causing more deaths and destruction in the last 24 hours. 4 civilians, including journalists, were killed and 16 others injured after Israeli warplanes struck the vicinity of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. Several areas of Gaza City were also shelled and bombed, leaving 2 people dead and 10 injured. Meanwhile, 4 Palestinians, including 2 children, died due to starvation in Kamal Adwan Hospital in the northern strip. The number of deaths related to famine and malnutrition has gone up to 34, including 31 children. Nearly 32,800 Palestinians have lost their lives and some 75,000 injured in the Israeli war on Gaza that began in early October. Israeli forces still attack hospitals in Gaza under the pretext of finding members of the Hamas resistance movement. A mother grieves the death of his 9-year-old son in Kamal Adwan Hospital as she recounts the moment IOF troops attacked the patients and their families there.
Suddenly they closed the doors and there was shooting. We said maybe there is a truce that we didn't know anything about yet. The doctors and nurses were screaming and saying that Israeli besieged us outside. They started shooting at the doors to get Hamas out. But where is Hamas? They are all sick children and there is no Hamas, only the medical staff and these children. Is my dead son Hamas? What did my son do to them? All the hospital sections were called to the reception. They took the displaced people out in groups of 40. The first day 40, the second, the third, and the fourth as well. On the fifth day, they said that they want to evacuate the families of patients and leave the patients. They told me to leave my son alone. I said I will not go and leave him. Some operations were delayed. There are no medical equipment or medicine in the Al-Shifa hospital. There is nothing. The seventh day, the doctor came to me and told me that I should go out and that the Israeli forces want to enter the hospital and that I was putting my life and the life of my son in danger. They told me to go out and take him with me. I went out and I put him in his chair and then they started shooting. So I carried him on my shoulders and there was people and patients behind me. Once we got out, they started shooting at us again, telling us that this is not a safe area and we should go right. Then they started shooting again, saying that this is not a safe area as well. We were in the middle of the thing, and we didn't know what to do. We then came to Kamal Adwan Hospital, and they did what's necessary directly. He had a blockage in his intestines, and today he died. His father knows nothing about him. He only knows that he's sick. He's not around. He didn't get the chance to say goodbye.
At least 3 Israeli settlers have been seriously injured in a stabbing attack by a Palestinian in the occupied territories. The attack took place in a shopping mall at a settlement near the town of Ashdod. According to reports, regime forces fatally shot the attacker, who was later identified as a man from Al-Khalil. The incident came hours after the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas resistance movement, republished a message from its commander calling on Palestinians to use all their resources to fight against the regime. Hamas later hailed the attack as a natural response to the occupations, massacres in Gaza and the West Bank. The group added, the operation also shows Palestinians' conviction towards resistance as the path to liberate Palestine. Thousands of Israelis have once again rallied in Tel Aviv and Al-Quds to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his failure to secure the release of captives in Gaza. The protesters urged Netanyahu to resign and called for early elections. They vowed to continue their rallies until all Israeli captives are released. Netanyahu has been in hot water over his handling of the Gaza war. Israel has failed to release any of the captives by military means. It has also failed to achieve any of the stated goals of the war. Israelis have held anti-Netanyahu rallies for months. The premier is embroiled in a series of scandals and charges, including fraud and breach of trust. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and Israeli forces continue to exchange fire as tensions remain high over the war in Gaza. In the latest of such tensions, the Lebanese resistance has carried out several retaliatory operations against Israeli positions in southern Lebanon. This after an assassination drone assault targeted a vehicle in Lebanon's southern town of Kunin. Our correspondent Maryam Saleh has the details.
The most dangerous aggression today from the Israeli side was that an Israeli drone targeted a vehicle in the southern town of Kunin. And we're talking about an assassination, it seems. We know from reports that there was one person in that vehicle. And that has become part of the Israeli policy of targeting individuals, which could be members of either the Hamas. As you know, Hamas is active in Lebanon. It does have a branch here in Lebanon, and they are active in South Lebanon. We also see that the Israelis are targeting, when they do have intelligence, they're targeting some vehicles that include members of Hezbollah. But in times, there's also targeting of civilians in their vehicles as well. Hezbollah has made it, of course, clear that they will continue to retaliate for the continuous Israeli aggressions. And there were several operations today. Hezbollah targeted the post of Jordah. They targeted specifically, they said, the espionage devices in that post. They also targeted the Zibdin post and the Ruwaisat al-Anam, which has become a routine operation for Hezbollah, targeting the occupied Lebanese Shabab farms. We also saw today targeting of a recent post, which is called the Barakta launching site, where the Israelis keep their tanks and their artillery, and they launch their aggressions from that area. And Hezbollah mentioned in their statement that this is a recent post, and this shows that Hezbollah, that the Israelis are attempting to move away from their original posts, perhaps trying to stave off any Hezbollah operations. But Hezbollah seems to have the intelligence to be able to know about these recent posts and target them as well.
Israelis have carried out fresh strikes on Syria, targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. The Syrian military says the rockets were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It added the aggression resulted in the injury of two civilians and caused some material losses. The attack comes 2 days after the regime's fatal airstrikes on Syria's Aleppo killed a number of civilians and military personnel. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has carried out fresh attacks on Israeli positions in response to the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza. The resistance group said it struck a vital target in occupied Palestine using appropriate weapons. It said the attack was in response to the massacres committed by Israel against Palestinian civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. The group said it will continue with its operations against Israeli strongholds. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli positions. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has acknowledged his party's poor performance in Sunday's local elections, calling the outcome a turning point for the Justice and Development Party, also known as the AK Party.
We will open-heartedly analyze the results of the March 31st elections within our party and make our self-criticism boldly. Although not finalized yet, the election results show us that we are experiencing a loss of ground in local administrations across the country. Of course, we will discuss the reasons for this decline we see on the local basis.
Erdogan issued a statement after early results squashed his party's hopes of winning municipality and mayoral seats in Istanbul and Ankara and some other traditional strongholds. The opposition Republican People's Party has already declared victory for Ekrem İmamoğlu, incumbent mayor of Istanbul, after 96% of ballot boxes were counted. Partial official tallies also showed the CHP was leading in other big cities such as Izmir, Bursa, Antalya and Adana. Sunday's local elections appear to represent a fresh blow to the president, who has set his sights on retaking control of urban areas. but the outcome is the repeat of the 2019 municipal elections when the CHP turned victorious against Erdogan's party in major cities.
Turkish people in 81 provinces took to the polls to choose mayors and provincial council members in local elections. The vote is seen by many as a test of popularity of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan, who started his political life as the mayor of Istanbul, campaigned for the past few weeks to promote his party's candidates. The ruling Justice and Development Party is seeking to win back both the economic hub of the country, Istanbul, and capital Ankara, after receiving a blow from Republican People's Party, CHP, in 2019. For his turn, the CHP is scrambling to maintain both cities and win more. All eyes are now on Istanbul, as the competition between the two main candidates in the city is crucial.
The participation wasn't expected to be the same as the previous election. However, it's not less important than the 2023 one. Erdogan wants to end his presidential term with a victory for his party. And opposition candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu, who wants to participate in the 2028 presidential run, wants this local election to pave the way for his next win.
61 million voters were eligible to vote, with more than 1 million new voters.
I cast my vote for the very first time. I am happy I was able to practice my democratic right. It does not matter who wins, as long as he works for this city and for our district. I want the best for my city, aside from political ideologies.
Mayor of Istanbul Ekrem İmamoğlu and the AKP's candidate Murat Kurum were campaigning for improving services for the city's 60 million residents at a time of widespread economic hardship and double-digit inflation. İmamoğlu has been criticized during his term for heavily focusing on presidential election and his party's leadership rather than solving issues in the city, such as the transportation and the traffic problems and multitude of other issues when heavy snowfall crippled life in Istanbul.
For the past 10 years, I have been living in Istanbul, and I found that the previous mayor, he didn't give the promise he planned to do inside Istanbul. According to the service, the management of the city, we didn't find any change in this situation. For that, I preferred to give the AK Party again, because I think they lost the election last time. It was like a kind of punishment from the people, and I think they learned a good from this lesson.
Opposition party supporters consider this election as another chance to topple the Justice and Development Party and win back power in the country.
I voted for Ekrem İmamoğlu and CHP. I have always supported CHP and will vote for them every time, for this could be our last exit from this nightmare.
Erdogan, who was the mayor of Istanbul in 1994, said during a rally that Istanbul is the jewel, the treasure, and the apple of our country's eye. Analysts say the person that rules Istanbul is able to establish himself a political base, which then translates into power at the national scale. Who wins Istanbul wins Turkey. That's what Erdogan, a mayor of the city in the 1990s, was quoted by a pollster as saying. Against that backdrop, Istanbul today could be choosing Turkey's future president. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In Pakistan, people have shown solidarity with Palestinians in the war-torn Gaza by holding protests and setting up roadside iftar meals in Ramadan. They have condemned Israel's brutalities and called for an immediate ceasefire in the besieged territory, in particular in the holy month of Ramadan. Nasser Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
This year, the holy month of Ramadan in Pakistan has been dedicated to the oppressed people of Gaza, with Pakistanis asserting that they will never forget the plight of Palestinians in war-torn Gaza. Throughout Ramadan, they have continued to raise their voices against Israel's brutalities and the genocidal war on Gaza. This week, activists from Save Gaza campaign organized protest demonstrations in all major cities of the country. They also staged protest sit-ins to condemn what they perceive as Israel's barbarism in Gaza.
Pakistan should move on international fora, United Nations, OIC, and other international fora for ceasefire to save Gaza. to sell Palestinians to stop this genocide, number one. Number two, establish a humanitarian assistance corridor. Number three, start proceeding against Israel in international court of justice and international criminal court, and also on the platform of the OIC for their war crimes, for their crime against humanity in Gaza.
While leaving the comfort of their houses behind, individuals from different faiths and backgrounds gather on the streets, setting up makeshift iftar meals to break their fast during Ramadan. These gatherings were not just about sharing food, they were about sharing solidarity, empathy, and hope for the people of Gaza.
This is the message from D Chowk, Islamabad, Pakistan, that we are with you. Our hearts are beating in Gaza, and for the regimes across the globe, our message is that you have been exposed. Your so-called democracy, your so-called freedom of speech, your so-called international humanitarian law are badly exposed.
Images of destruction and suffering from the Israeli war sparked a wave of empathy among people from various walks of life in Pakistan, prompting them to increase their advocacy campaign within their communities for the plight of oppressed people in Gaza.
The gesture of Pakistanis holding protest demonstrations and breaking their fasts on the streets to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza underscores their steadfast commitment to amplifying voices against Israel's ongoing genocide and advocating for a ceasefire. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Republic Day. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed on 11th of February 1979. Less than 2 months after this greatest event of the 20th century, the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, called on people to take part in a referendum to determine the type of system of government in Iran. Therefore, on 30th and 31st of March 1979, the nationwide referendum was held, and over 98.2% of the participants voted yes to the Islamic Republic as the ruling system in the country. Thus, 1st of April was named as the Islamic Republic Day in the Iranian calendar. This way of determination and formation of the ruling system has not had any precedent in history, even in the so-called democratic societies of the West. In view of the fact that the Iranian nation is a Muslim nation and had struggled for Islam for decades, especially with the leadership of Imam Khomeini, Some officials and analysts maintained that there was no need to hold a referendum, but the imam insisted on a clear and public referendum. The founder of the Islamic Republic said in his message to the Iranian people, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will either draw you to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and dependence on others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in. You can choose any form that you want. You have the right and are able to write on this paper democratic republic, royal regime, or whatever you want. You are free in this." On this great day, the faithful Iranian people demonstrated their national unity and Islamic solidarity with their decisive vote to fortify the basis of the Islamic Revolution. They altered the history of mankind with their fateful election. The Iranian people dismantled the long history of despotism, oppression, and disgraceful colonialism for good. The Islamic Republic has been the most democratic system of government in the past centuries, for superior to the democratic rule which has been claimed and propagated for decades by hired thinkers and writers in the West. The Islamic Republic is built up of two parts, Islam and the people. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, insists on calling it religious popular rule rather than man-made flawed Western democracy, which has proved its deficiencies and even contradictions with the votes of people. The establishment of the Islamic Republic not only proved the Iranian nation's will and their fate, but it also inspired hope in the hearts of the oppressed and downtrodden in the world. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, called 1st of April as a feast and said in a message, "The morning of 1st of April, which is the first day of Allah's rule, is one of our greatest religious and national feasts. Our nation should hold this day as feast and keep it alive." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "There is another feature in our Islamic Republic Day, namely, it is not the feast of us, the Iranian people, rather it can be the feast of all those who are Muslims. It means nearly 1 billion people worldwide. They, meaning the Muslim nations, have also got used to seeing Islam in the state of defense and passive position, in the state of isolation. When a nation stands in the position of attacking the domineering powers and aggressive, incomplete man-made systems, and proclaims a republic on the basis of Islam, this is certainly something to be proud of and take honour in for Muslim nations. In short, there are various features in the Islamic Republic Day." Clearly, the formation of the Islamic Republic system in Iran created a new theory among the political theories of the East and the West. Article 56 of Iran's constitution reads, "Absolute rule over the world and human being belongs to God, and it is He who has made human being ruler of his social fate. Nobody can dispossess human beings of this divine right or put it at the service of the interests of a special individual or a special group of people. And the nation wields this God-given right in the ways that will come in the next articles." The establishment of the Islamic Republic system of government in Iran, besides domestic developments, caused different changes in the region and the wider world, which were not compliant with the unholy goals of the colonialist powers. In view of this, the enemies of Islam and the Iranian nation hatched various plots to topple this system of government. These plots began since the first days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and escalated after the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They included the imposition of an 8-year war on Iran, assassination of political, religious and revolutionary figures and officials, sanctions on Iran's economy, creation of barriers on the way of achieving peaceful nuclear energy, assassination of scientists, especially nuclear scientists in Iran, and commanders of the resistance front, and fomenting riots in various Iranian cities. Now the Islamic Revolution has arrived at its 46th year, and the Islamic Republic has already started the second phase of its life. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Why has the Islamic Republic not suffered the destiny of other systems and other revolutions despite this much hostility? What is the reason and the mystery? I tell you that the splendid and honourable mystery of the system and its longevity is because of these two words, Republic and Islamic. The juxtaposition of these two words and the system of government which is based upon these two words should naturally be permanent. Both the Republic and the Islamic, people and Islam. Republic means people and Islamic means Islam, religious popular rule. The feat of our great Imam was that he created this thought, this theory. The theory of the Islamic Republic brought it among various political theories, as in that era different political theories were in contact with each other in the East and the West, in the field of political issues and political mentalities. He realized this new system of government, it was not merely the creation of a theory, but he materialized it and created the Islamic Republic. This was Imam Khomeini's greatest feat."
Hello everyone, thank you for being with us again. I'm Amina Taylor, and this edition of Gaza Under Attack, with us for this edition of the program, in the studio alongside myself, the journalist and broadcaster Ted Kofi, and with us via Skype from Johannesburg in South Africa, Tsetso Magama. Tsetso is a long-time political activist, and he served in various roles within the African National Congress, the ANC, as well as leading other grassroots movements in South Africa. And he joins us in his capacity as the spokesperson for Africa for Palestine. Welcome to you both. Tsetso, we know that South Africa has done more than be empathetic. They've really been using every power at its disposal to get a cessation of violence here. So do you think this move by the UN Security Council has come too little too late here, especially when you have nations like South Africa pushing forward for more?
Well, I mean, within the context of the suffering that is taking place amongst the Palestinian people in Gaza at the moment, you know, it can never be too little too late. Indeed, it is late in the day. And of course, we should, as we ought to be worried about, the fact that this ceasefire will only last for the remainder of Ramadan, which is roughly about 2 weeks. What we would have liked to see is, of course, a permanent ceasefire. And of course, you know, accompanied by a path towards a resolution of the fundamental grievance of the Palestinian people. Because without that, you know, this is only a short respite. And Palestinians cannot be asked to give up their right to resist against, you know, resist such a brutal occupation and apartheid. And so that's what we would have liked to see. But as it were, you don't always get what you want. And so given that, I think the fundamental issue now for us is to the extent that it's possible to alleviate the suffering, to minimize the suffering of the people there, getting the humanitarian aid, and of course, you know, they have a ceasefire, and then the process, a process can then unfold, because I think that should give us the international community, to the extent that there is something called an international community, given this, of course, you know, disastrous, catastrophic failure of the United Nations system.
Indeed. Let me just ask you this very briefly and your response in less than a minute, please. We've seen no compliance thus far. 76 people have died over the past just hours. They didn't adhere to the ICJ's interim ruling. Why are they going to adhere to this one?
Look, I think Minister Naledi Pandor was, she had a very concrete proposal. Very concrete proposal. She said, look, let the powerful armies of the world go into Gaza, deliver humanitarian aid, and that probably is the only thing that will force Israel to adhere. Will Israel bomb, you know, target Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian or the Egyptian forces, or the United Kingdom's forces? Because the UK and other powers, especially the P5 members, of course, excluding the United States, you know, the permanent members, will Israel do that? No, they won't. And so in the same way that they are certainly not going to target the Biden's so-called peer in Gaza, they're certainly not going to target Russian forces or Chinese forces when they deliver humanitarian aid. And that,
indeed,
of course,
let's stick a needle in this point and come right back to it, because I'm keen to hear how we address the rest of this lack of compliance here. But very briefly now to a more domestic position, because since October the 7th, the UK has abstained in every ceasefire vote at the UN Security Council until last week. We asked the pro-Palestinian activist Aman Shahzad what he thought was behind the UK's change of heart.
I believe there's so many agendas, whether it's a country for the economy, whether it's a politician for their votes. There's always going to be the agendas in the, to begin with. I think it's a prime example is Keir Starmer, the head of Labour, the head of opposition in the UK. His stance on the conflict going back 2-3 months ago, he was in fact violating international law, saying that Israel have a right to cut off supplies of food, water and electricity. Now his stance is that there should be an immediate ceasefire around a month ago. I think there's complete and utter carnage within politics. I feel like people are just picking and choosing who they want to support, when they want to support it, whenever it suits them. Now they've done polls in the UK to show that Muslim voters, I think it's 38% of Muslim voters said they're unfavourable towards Labour compared to their stance and position last year. The pressure is on the elections now. Even Joe Biden, again, has taken a step back from his stance. Although it's important to note that, again, the US abstained from the vote when it came to this UN resolutions. So I do feel like there's a lot of political agendas that are being pushed.
Aman, who's also a Nasheed artist, said pro-Palestinian activism is even more important now than before. Just because a ceasefire vote has been achieved, it doesn't mean Palestinians are safe or at peace.
Firstly, it's very important for all the motions, all the movements in the UK that support Palestine to unify as one. There should be, I think they had the London protests going on for a period of 3-4 months every single weekend. And I think that's very important that we continue that pressure in London, outside the Prime Minister's home, outside the Israeli embassy, where we stand as one, united in our millions to show that we are all Palestinians, we support the cause, we stand against genocide. It's very, very easy for this government to paint this picture that those who support Palestine are actually pro-Hamas, those who support Palestine are actually, you know, should be investigated. I think this is a very, very tactical kind of pursuit by the government, and it's completely unfair. Therefore, there needs to be people who are educated, people who stand and speak. There needs to be media outlets like, you know, there's Novara Media, who's done amazing work. There's Owen Jones. There's so many media platforms that are doing amazing work. These need to be pushed into the media, and we need to stop the censoring of information. And by doing that, obviously be careful with what content you're posting, and please keep pushing this cause forward on social media, on your platforms, and don't, I keep boycotting as well. And the final thing I'd say is put pressure on MPs. I mean, amazing news just about a couple of weeks ago, we had George Galloway run for MP, actually won in that region. I think there needs to be a new wave of independent candidates who don't have a chief party whip, who can make decisions in Parliament, who can kind of have a stance and a view without having the view of the party. I think that's definitely one way. Put pressure on your local councillors, put pressure on your MPs. That's the way forward.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has called the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, a lifeline of hope and dignity, as he urges countries who've paused funding to reinstate the urgent support. Guterres also spoke of Israel's growing isolation in light of the global calls to respect the ceasefire vote at the UN. Let's listen in.
I deeply regret the decision that was taken to stop funding to UNRWA, and I strongly hope that that measure will be revoked, especially when the reports that we are now preparing by independent entities on investigation and the review of UNRWA will be published. I see a growing consensus emerging international community to tell the Israelis that the ceasefire is needed. And I also see a growing consensus. I heard it in the US. I heard it from the European Union, not to mention, of course, the Muslim world. A growing consensus to tell clearly to the Israelis that any ground invasion of Rafah could mean a catastrophic humanitarian disaster. And I strongly hope that this consensus that is emerging in the whole of the international community will make Israel reflect and avoid what could be a dramatic tragedy.
So much to get through in so little time. Let me go through those developments with the last moments we have left on this edition of Gaza Under Attack. Ted Kofi and Tsetso Magama are still with me. Tsetso, before we went on that a slight segue there, you had some thoughts about the South African position of putting an army in place to deliver this aid, to get the situation moving. Just please continue on that track for us, please. We've got about 3.5 minutes of the program left.
Yeah, okay, briefly. Look, Minister Pando made a proposal when asked the very same question. How do you get this, if such a decision were to be made by the Security Council, how do we get it to be implemented? And she mused about the possibility of deploying of, you know, especially powerful countries in the region, and of course those members, permanent members of the Security Council, to deploy their militaries. And then the question that naturally arises is, will Israel target French, American, British, you know, Egyptian troops, you know, delivering humanitarian aid? No, they certainly won't. And that should effectively bring Israel's operations to an end. So the question then becomes, do we have those countries, especially those in the region, the ones in the global north, it's highly questionable, but do we have the political will in the capitals of the global south, and in particular in the region, especially those countries that have the gravitas in the region, to take such a step to get Israel, to force Israel's hand in this matter? And that's the only way, because as we know, the Security Council doesn't have its own mechanisms of implementing its resolutions. It relies on member states that have the capabilities and the resources to do it. Those countries are right there. They have the capabilities. They've had billions of dollars to bomb Yemen. It shouldn't be a difficult task to send in their militaries to protect the people of Gaza.
Indeed, Tisetso, we always seem to have money for the bombing but not the cleanup. Ted, the floor is yours for the last portion. I mean, we can see that there's been a reaction. There is even the threat of legal action to get Britain to unpause its UNRWA funding. So many different things have been happening in this respect. But if Israel say, look, we're not even going to listen to you right now, does it matter what the rest of us do?
Well, it just goes to show that this problem with Palestine, with Gaza, has to be looked at in twin tracks. The tactical solutions that Tetzo, for example, has talked about, it's a brilliant solution. It's 1+1=2. It's a slam dunk, as they would say. However, for that to happen, you have to understand that the underpinnings, the strategic issues, must also be addressed. As long as Israel is buying weapons, as long as Israel is the Western powers' aircraft carrier in the sea of the Middle East, as long as the Western powers have a strategic interest in maintaining Israel there to look after their geopolitical requirements in the region, it's going to be very difficult for legal machinations, UN machinations, brilliant minds like Tshisekedi putting up these ideas for it to function. That's why
Indeed.
Edmund Burke said, you know, for evil to flourish, all that is required is for good people to do nothing.
And the Gazans can well think we've been sitting on our hands, Tet. It does it for us for the moment. Ted Kofi and Tshisekedi Magama were my special guests. And our thanks to them and, of course, to you for being with us. And until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, asking for forgiveness in the holy month of Ramadan as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here in the holy month of Ramadan at your service. So, dear friends, we are talking about asking for forgiveness in the holy month of Ramadan as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, asking for forgiveness is a very important thing that we must do in the holy month of Ramadan. The Almighty Allah in many places, whether it is the Holy Quran or the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, has talked about how this is the month of forgiveness, and this is a month in which the sins are forgiven. Now, this is kind of like a very, you know, easy form or easy time for us to be able to ask for forgiveness, right? Because it seems like that the other months of the year, yes, we can be forgiven, but it seems like the holy month of Ramadan has a special emphasis on it when it comes to asking for forgiveness. One, to receiving forgiveness. So this is why it's been highly encouraged to not only ask for forgiveness in this holy month of Ramadan, but also to believe and hope that the Almighty Allah has forgiven us, keeping in mind that this should not lead us towards becoming arrogant or haughty or, you know, proud or these kind of things. We always have to be humble, even when it comes to having hope in receiving the forgiveness of the Almighty Allah. But this is the best opportunity, the holy month of Ramadan, in which we should be asking for forgiveness, and on a regular basis. It shouldn't be something that we do on and off, something that, you know, we do one day and then the rest of the 28 or 29 days we have nothing to do with seeking forgiveness. Actually, seeking forgiveness and istighfar in its various, you know, verbal forms, because you can say astaghfirullah, astaghfirullah wa atubu ilay, astaghfirullah rabbi wa atubu ilay. So in the different forms, this istighfar is incredibly important.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان رمضان رمضان القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about istighfar and seeking forgiveness in this holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. Of course, you know, after so many programs on A to Z about the holy month of Ramadan, if nothing else, we have definitely learned that in the holy month of Ramadan, the things that we learn and the things that we inculcate and practice in these 29 or 30 days are things that we should try our best to continue throughout the rest of our year and our life, and thus it becomes a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So we're talking about seeking forgiveness, and you know, really it's incredibly important to seek forgiveness in this holy month, because it is relatively so much more easier to be forgiven in this holy month than other holy months, right? So in the holy month of Ramadan, during these best of days and these best of nights, as the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi says, we should ask for istighfar, and we should ask for the forgiveness of the Almighty Allah, and we should repent and turn back to the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, there are different forms. We don't have too much time to get into it. But very quickly, I'll try my best. You know, one is this verbal saying or repetition of the word astaghfirullah. And so this repetition of the word and realizing that astaghfirullah is this kind of a request from the Almighty Allah to be forgiven, that's one level. Then the levels that come after that, of course, deal with one actually remembering the different errors or mistakes that have occurred in one's life and really actively asking for forgiveness for those things, being ashamed, being regretful. And then after that, to try one's best to not go back and commit those things. And if, God forbid, for whatever reason, we do end up committing the same sin again afterwards, to again ask for forgiveness and again never stop asking for forgiveness and never stop trying to stop sinning. Eventually, by the grace of the Almighty Allah, you will succeed. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me
Welcome to Have It Out with Galloway. Every single week, I'll be here discussing the hottest topics, the biggest world events, but perhaps from a perspective that you will not find easily on the mainstream media. I'm joined tonight, and in fact, every week, with a group of distinguished panelists, as well as an interested live studio audience. Our guest tonight, Low Key, is a rapper, a hip-hop artist, an investigative journalist, and his critically acclaimed music has millions of streams on Spotify. Over 25,000 digital downloads and over 45 million YouTube views. Low Key breaks the ground for independent political music. He's also the host of The Watchdog, a podcast on Mint Press News. Dr. Marwa Osman is a journalist and a presenter. She holds a PhD and two masters and is a university lecturer at the Lebanese International University and Maarif University. She hosts and produces political shows, as well as being a writer, with her comments being published by a whole variety of outlets. And Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and human rights activist from the north of Ireland. He has written several books, including An Activist's Tale, My Walk with Palestine, which chronicles his experiences as an international activist and his involvement with the Viva Palestina 5 medical aid convoy. His work focuses on the role of activism in promoting justice and human rights. And a plethora of interested and interesting audience guests joining us from all over the world who'll be chipping in throughout the show. But let me turn first, if I may, to Dr. Marwa. Do you think, as I do, that there will be no justice forthcoming in the so-called international legal system, that being more or less lipstick on the pig of injustice that the world order has been, but that there may be accountability and a holding to account in political change in Western countries? Where do you stand?
Well, I'll tell you, George, from experience, that how Lebanon dealt with the non-existent international community and the ineffective UNSC resolutions is that we took our land back, we kicked the Zionists out by our own heroes, by the people who are native to the land, aka the resistance. So we really, as natives of West Asia, as natives of the Levant in specific, that region, me coming from a region that is on the border with both occupied Palestine and the Golan Heights. I remember on October 7th, actually, I was with you on one of your shows, and we spoke about what the prospects were, and I was there. I was in my house on the border between occupied Palestine and the Golan Heights, and I told you that we support the resistance, we believe in the resistance, and I still say that. Why do I say that? Because despite the fact that it's been 6 months that I've been displaced from my house, right there where I was with you 6 months ago, because of Zionist Israel, not because they wanted to wage a war, but because our people, my resistance in Lebanon, stood steadfast and said, we will not let go of our brothers and sisters in Gaza. We will not leave them be alone. We will engage. And we in Lebanon attacked posts, military posts for the Zionist entity in support of Palestine. So hence why we didn't even wait. It started on October 8 at 6:45 a.m. I was there. I watched it firsthand. I started reporting from there. This is great example, George, of how we operate here. We don't wait for justice that is going to come from the international community or from the UNSC or from the global powers, because we know that it does not exist. Mm-hmm. We know that they operate in a way that only garners interests for their own colonial power, for their own imperial power, for their own entities, the likes of the cancerous Zionist entity in our region. And if you look at the UNSC draft resolution that was passed today, you could clearly see that it is in the favor of Zionist Israel, by the way. Yes, we want Gaza to breathe. We need some sort of a ceasefire for the people to breathe, especially in Ramadan. But on the same page, you could see that it is actually in the interest of the Zionist entity, which has been losing a very strategic loss in history that they have not been lived before. They have never experienced before this kind of level of defeat.
Well, they're beginning to lose friends also, Dr. Marwa. And as we go to air, one of those might be the Prime Minister of Canada, one of the Zionist state's most powerful friends. Let's go to one of my most powerful friends, one of my oldest friends, Dr. Mala, who joins us from Canada in Ontario. Doctor, wonderful to see you again. Any update you can give us? The air is full of rumors that Israel's friend Justin Trudeau might be in his last days.
Yes, Habibi George, I'm talking of oldest friend, just talk of yourself. You know, it's a spirit by, youthful spirit, whether for you or for many others. And let me take the opportunity to say salam and a greeting to dear sister Dr. Marwa and Sakina and dear friend and comrade Fra. You know, in this segment so far, there are so many themes could be discussed at length and which we haven't come across and discussed yet. But let me start from Canada. As you know, Canada might be out, but you know the question who will be in is more important, because if it is the conservative, then you'll be talking about a Zionist government in Canada. And that, you know, takes me to the point, George. Can you tell me where on this globe the UK was not and has not been complicit? Can we name any continent where the UK or the, you know, Great Britain has not been complicit in genocide and crimes? If there is a justice on this world, so most leaders throughout the centuries of the UK and Western entities should be rotten in jail. You worked very hard against the genocide of Iraqi people, and you were accused. And what this led to, the lies of Tony Blair and George Bush, led to more than 1 million Iraqi dead. You know, you want to take any other part of the world and you will see literally the rulers of the British, you know, throughout many centuries, their hands is soaking with the blood of people from all over, from the Philippines to Australia to Canada. Look at the map, Australia and Canada, they are at the totally different ends of the world. And what the UK did with, you know, the First Nation and Aboriginal people, they committed massacres against them, George, and you know it, and you talk about it. So the question is, what can we, you and me and all of us, do to attempt to bring some justice to the victims of the UK and Western imperialism and colonialism and the crimes? You know, maybe
well,
by election, somebody
the reason the sun never set on the British Empire is because God would never trust us in the dark, as you well know. But in Ireland, of course, for 800 years before we started occupying other people, we occupied Ireland and held it as a colony and visited famine upon it. Ireland didn't starve. Ireland was starved, just like Gaza was starved, is being starved. Let's go back to Fra Hughes in Ireland for a perspective on that. Fra, welcome.
Thanks, George. As I said earlier on, just about what happened with the famine, that's why the Irish people have such an affinity and such empathy for what's happening in Palestine. We suffered from military occupation, we suffered from massacres, we suffered from ethnic cleansing and partial colonization of the north of Ireland in the 17th century. So I only see the difference between what's happening in Palestine and Gaza today, which is on such an inhuman, monstrous scale. It's just a time scale. What happened in Ireland in the 19th century with the famine is exactly being replicated today in Gaza. Starvation being used as a weapon of war, starvation being used as a form of subjugation. And it appears that starvation is being used as part of the Zionist regime's negotiations behind the scenes with Hamas. I just touched earlier briefly that, you know, Hamas was trying to get an extended